Hi, and welcome to the Rare Business Podcast. My name is Adrian Swinsko, and I'm a consultant, advisor, researcher, and writer on all things related to customer service and customer experience. Through this podcast, I seek out and interview CEOs, entrepreneurs, business and tech leaders, and leading thinkers about what it takes to build organizations that produce better outcomes for both customers and employees in this fast-moving modern age that we live in. If this is your first time listening to one of these interviews, then welcome. And please do dive into the archives at adrianswinsko.com, as I've now completed over 250 of these interviews in the last few years. If this is not your first time listening, then thank you for returning, and I'll aim to do a good enough job to keep you coming back week after week. Anyway, that's enough from me right now. Let's get into the interview. So welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Michael Redbord, who is the GM of Service Hub across at HubSpot. Now, for some of you who may be either avid or periodic or possibly erstwhile listeners or even just sometime listeners, some of you might remember that Michael and I spoke for the first time actually back in May of last year, so about just over a year ago. So first of all, hi Michael, and welcome back. How are you doing?
Hi Adrian, thanks for having me back. Thrilled to be here with you again. Hi listeners, great to be back with you.
And so for the people that have are letting me down and not sticking around on a weekly or kind of every kind of 10-day sort of cycle and are not necessarily familiar with your background, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and also about the work that you do?
Yeah, so I work at a software company called HubSpot. We make software for small and medium-sized businesses. And nowadays, what I'm doing is building something called Service Hub, which is service software for small and medium-sized businesses. But I think, you know, if I really think about myself and try to communicate, you know, my background, my tradecraft, as it were, like I'm a support guy. I'm a service guy. I spent, you know, 6-7 years running the support and service teams here at HubSpot as we scaled from a small company to a public company. And really, that's what I love. That's what I consider myself an expert in. Now I just get the joy of building software to help people, you know, service and support better. So that's a little bit about me anyway. I'm really a support guy at the core.
Fantastic. And we love it. We love support guys and girls as well, obviously. And so, but the thing that that brought us together, now there's a couple of things we wanted to talk about, but the first thing we wanted to talk about was that HubSpot recently published a new piece of research. Now, I'm a big lover of research and numbers and stuff and what they tell us and the stories that we can spin out of them. But the piece of research was called The State of Customer Service in 2019. Now, that's quite a heavy title. It's like the state of. But so can you tell me a little bit about why you conducted the research? Is it a one-off? And what sort of the headline findings are before we kind of dig into it a bit further?
Yeah, so I really wanted to do this research because over the course of my career, you know, running support teams and working with customers, started to develop some, I don't know, hypotheses, some feelings about the way the industry was going, about the way customers were going. And I wanted to understand if some of those hypotheses were right or wrong. So we did the State of Customer Service. It's really the first one, right? We hope to do it annually and update it and start to produce some really cool trends. But okay, some of the hypotheses were like, you know, do people trust less? Are people really more impatient? How is that affecting service and relationships between brands and customers? And I think we unearthed some really interesting and sometimes kind of disturbing stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, because I think that's the thing. There is this kind of, there's a lot of stuff that sort of goes around that this, you know, I think it's interesting about research, about testing hypotheses, because a lot of people come out with these almost like very platitudinal statements, you know, time is going faster. And you're like going, no, it's not. It's got the same rate as it got before. Like, I have no time. Like, yes, you do. You have the same amount of time as everybody else. And so it's almost a bit like exploding kind of myths and really understanding what's kind of going on. So, but the thing I'd like to dig into a few of the findings that I found really interesting. And that's as a way of giving people a flavor of the report, because then they can go and kind of, we'll point them in the right direction for where they can go and find it kind of later on. Now, what the thing I wanted to start with was this finding that says only 12% of customers, when they say they solve for the customer or put the customer first. Now, I was like, what? I mean, can you tell me about this and what is driving this? I mean, it's surprising, right? It's a bit like going, people have been talking about trust and trust deficits and all that sort of stuff for like a while now, but that's a bit like, there is not a deficit. Like, we're in a ditch if this is true, right?
I think we're in some ways in the bottom of the trust deficit ditch, right? So what we found is 12% of customers believe a company when the company claims to be customer first. Mm-hmm. So when the company stands up and says that, basically everybody immediately calls BS on it and disbelieves them, right? And I think, you know, some of the other research in the study added some color as to why. So we found out, for instance, that about half of the small and medium-sized businesses we surveyed are not using some of the tools you would expect them to use. They're not using a proper help desk shared inbox system. They don't value a knowledge base. They're not really collecting and actioning customer feedback. And so in a world where half of businesses are not doing the basic things they need to do, but all businesses are saying, we're customer first, it shouldn't be a surprise that the customer who's kind of stuck in the middle of this dishonesty is distrusting, right? Because it's been, you know, years of this kind of this dynamic, and now customers are just, they're fed up with it.
So here's the thing that strikes me about that, because I think there's two statistics, and they're probably not comparable, but I'm going to compare them anyway for the sake of illustration. And there's a statistic that came from, I think it was Edelman's research, the Trust Barometer research, a few years ago. And they were saying that only about 17% of people believe what companies say about themselves in their own sort of advertising and marketing. That's sort of in the same sort of like area in terms of believability, as it were. But possibly you could probably imply that you can go, well, is it getting worse, or and so on and so forth. And then you also can like said, well, maybe people customers aren't necessarily getting the most out of tools or not using them well enough and so on and so forth. But again, from a person who comes at it from I'm an advocate of employees, for employees and support and service and all that sort of stuff, but I'm also an advocate for customers and things. And I'm a bit like going, but it's not their fault.
Yeah, it's not the customer's fault, or it's not the service people's fault?
It's not the customer's fault.
Yeah, I think the customers are stuck in this morass of everybody promises the world and delivers the bare minimum they can to get away with making money off of you. And then the service people are sort of stuck in this similar situation where they're trying to do the right thing. Like most service workers are trying to solve for the customer, but they're hamstrung by their processes, by their incentives, and by their capabilities, right? And right. So you do end up, I think, with a playing field here that is a really poor one for customers. So I'm not surprised to hear 17%, 12% kind of categorically similar bad trust dynamics between businesses and customers.
Yeah, no, it is. It's almost a bit like, it's probably the finding, it's sort of, if you think about it the other way, it says if you want to get to that kind of point, if you want to almost like meet your rhetoric, you have to do more and work harder and give people more support, I guess, because it's what's absolutely clear, it's, you know, doing the bare minimum is not going to get you to good or even great, not even going to get you close.
Plus, you have this trust deficit, this trough you have to overcome, right? And I think you couple that with another one of the findings from the studies, which is that, you know, I think it was 89% of folks say they're more likely to share feedback publicly about their experience as a customer today than they were in the past, right? Yep. So in a world where also customers are empowered with this giant megaphone to define a brand's reputation, right? It's actually all that much more important, but also all that much harder to get over the trust gap and actually deliver a differentiated customer experience that's legitimately noteworthy and remarkable, because that's how you're actually going to grow as a brand. That's how you're going to define who you are through your customers more today than ever before.
Absolutely, and if you link to that in this other finding that it stood out for me, because it's a thing that's been around for a while. Well, it's ever since service has been a thing. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of the report, or actually in the blog post that you wrote about it, that about service is like, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of years kind of old. We've been talking about this for ages. I mentioned it in How to Wire, which I wrote in, you know, came out in 2016, is that this people complaining about service is not a new thing, right? But there was a finding in the report that says customer service professionals say their biggest challenges are dealing with upset customers. That's 49% of them. That's their biggest concern. The second biggest concern is not having enough time in the day. 46% of people said that. And managing organization and follow-up was the third biggest concern. That's 23%. Now, the latter two, not having enough time and managing organization and flow, you can see that's about structure and efficiency and productivity and tools and things. But the first one is I think it's a really, really persistent, perennial problem about how people deal with upset customers. So it's how they deal with conflict, their resilience, and how it impacts their well-being and, you know, and productivity and performance and all these different things. But it also links back to the first one I kind of mentioned as well. That whole idea is that if we don't invest, then it has a direct, almost a direct and significant impact on our employees. And then that has a cost to the business because that just feeds straight through to churn. And then employment, you know, training and hiring and productivity kind of costs on the back end. And I'm a bit like, what should companies be doing? I mean, is this kind of, they should be investing in more training, more systems, resourcing as investment, or is it back to the first point, i.e. just be better at everything?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think like when you trace the history of customer service, right, and you can go back to 1750 BC when the first recorded customer service complaints with an angry customer was actually recorded. It was recorded on a stone tablet, right? And it was a complaint saying the copper ingots you promised me were of an inferior quality to the quality that you said you would give me, says the customer on the stone
tablet.
That's
the one that's in the British Museum, right?
Yeah. So like this stuff has been going on forever because the laws of physics in this kind of dynamic is for the company to say X and then deliver, you know, basically the minimum possible to make a buck, right? And maybe it wasn't a buck back in the Roman days and it was a different currency, but it's always been the same dynamics and always the same laws of physics. I think what's changed now is a couple of things. Number one, customers just have so much more choice than they did, you know, 2,500 years ago or 25 years ago, right? Yeah. There's just such a proliferation of competition and choice. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, technology has progressed at a pace that we're not using stone tablets anymore. We're using chatbots and AI and clever stuff that's enabling certain businesses to have remarkably divergent, better customer experiences in many cases. So the gap between good experience and bad is really changing. And then third, you've got this world where customers want to and are empowered to share stories about good and bad experience. That kind of amplifies the whole thing. So I think like the pressures on businesses to deliver the minimum necessary are kind of still there. Just the bar has really gone up in terms of what customers expect and their ability to really punish you if you do a bad job or celebrate you if you're doing a good job. And so those are kind of the fundamental changes. And as a business then, you need to use that new technology, you need to figure out what a modern customer experience for your customers looks like so that you can win in the modern day because it's just that much harder.
So, but do you think therefore, but that, go back to that number that says 49 customer service professionals say their biggest challenge is dealing with upset customers, and that's 49% of them. Nearly half of all professionals, service and support professionals, say that that's the biggest issue that they deal with. And so surely the implication from that is that the number one priority for firms should be stop pissing off your customers.
Yeah, that 49 is good evidence of that first dynamic I just said, which the businesses promise the world and want to deliver as little as possible to make their money, right? Yeah. And I think in a world where you're creating that friction with your customers that's resulting in your customer service people spending half their time dealing with angry customers, you're not running a good shop. You need to look at the structure of the experience and like just what's happening on an individual basis to your customers and why is it the case that your service department is just full of complaints as opposed to helping?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a bit like you have to step back and chant, you know, you can't look at things in isolation. You have to kind of step back and look at things systemically and going, well, if you've got unhappy customers, there's something going wrong somewhere and it ain't the fault of the support people or your service professionals. It's like they're like your fire department in many ways. So it's like, you know, use the fire department analogy is like, well, if you kind of want to build, you know, safer houses, then you use fireproof materials. You know, it's not rocket science. And I guess you have to almost look at it in the same sort of way as from your business is like, don't blame the service people because they're the ones that deal with the outputs of everything else that you do.
Totally.
And so, yeah, it's fascinating because, you know, comes that, you know, people get beaten up a lot, and it's like, you know, I think one of the biggest issues in the whole support and service help desk kind of industries, and more broadly in the contact center industries, is the level of churn and how that impacts kind of like costs and overheads and performance and productivity and all those different things. And And it's just, in many times, I don't see many enough organizations paying enough attention to that and looking at it kind of holistically.
Yeah. I think that's actually a problem that gets worse and sort of a sharper one for many industries in the coming, 5-10 years. Like, I see a world today in which things like, chat automation, chatbots, AI, the ability of technology to handle some of the, frankly, simple and repetitive tasks that service teams deal with, that technology is really in its early days. Over the next 5 to 10 years, it's going to grow, become much stronger, and hopefully with that then, to take an optimistic point of view for a moment, hopefully with that change then, the service rep is elevated. They're sort of riding on top of this thing and push upwards in terms of sophistication by this technology because now, simple stuff is handled. In that world, not only do you still have the same churn problem with your employees, but that churn becomes much worse and much more expensive because their knowledge is becoming more sophisticated. They're becoming more sophisticated workers. If you can't get your churn under control and your workers are doing more sophisticated stuff, I think you're really going to have a problem as a brand in the future. So I'm right there with you that like understanding how the employee experience goes because it's so coupled to the customer experience is actually a pretty important dynamic.
Yeah. So do you think that actually many executives get that and are therefore frightened of that?
I don't think so. I don't think you see that unless you've spent a lot of time with a service team. Like I said, that's been my career. And for years, I sat on the floor just surrounded by service folks. I think that changes you to do that work and to be surrounded by that work and immersed in it. And you start to understand this dynamic where service people are plugged into a system. And in some ways, they're not the ones with the power, even though when a customer calls in, you think they are, right? Mm-hmm. But they're not really the ones with the power. It's really the business, it's the structure, and it's the business's incentives at a much deeper level, to turn that next like deal, or whatever it is, that's really the thing that the service people kind of get stuck in the middle of. And if, in many cases, a last thought on this one, if you let service people kind of run a little bit free and loosen up some of those shackles and controls of them, they actually produce amazingly good work because they want to help people. They care, they're empathetic, and they want to really help. The friction in that experience comes when you limit your service people through process, through too many Visio charts, and you say, this is the one way we handle this thing, when perhaps the answer is obvious if you just throw that away for a moment and think like a human being.
Yeah, absolutely. So then moving on, I then picked out this other finding in the report, which says that Forrester reports that 70% of customers prefer to use a company's website to get answers to their questions rather than use phone or email to contact the customer service department. Still, just over 56% of companies don't use a knowledge base to help their customers. Now, again, this is like the idea of self-service or being more proactive and all this has been around for a while, right? And the idea of, a little bit of systems thinking and what's value demand, what's failure demand, all that type of stuff.
Yeah.
But given those results, crumbs, what's stopping companies from developing these knowledge bases? Have they got writer's block or is it just it's just hard work and they don't have the skills or the time or they're struggling to get investment, to support these sort of things because people can't see the ROI.
It's sort of mind-boggling, right? And so, I think it's rightfully frustrating to be like, what is wrong with these organizations, right? And, it's clearly not the tools. The tools have been around forever. They're not new. Everybody's familiar with them. We as consumers are familiar with them. Certainly not that. You could argue it's resourcing, right? But I think if you peel the problem backwards, it's a lack of desire, a lack of recognition that you must match the way your customers want to be served with your service. And the more you try to wedge a customer through your own process, as opposed to matching the way that they want to get served, the worse the experience. Yeah. So if a modern day customer, at least me personally, I want to just Google everything. Right? I don't want to talk to anybody ever if I can avoid it. And a company that's not understanding that isn't really listening to its customers, isn't really studying their customers, and that, of course, isn't matching the way their customers want to actually be interacted with. They're just missing the boat, I think.
I think you're not abnormal in your desire to kind of just want to kind of Google everything or just kind of to search them and get the answer and then be done with it. But it's almost like there is that conditionality on the end of it. You're like going, I want to Google it. I want to try and self-service. I want to try and fix myself. But when I kind of come unstuck, then I want to pick up the phone and I want to speak to somebody, and I don't want to have to wait kind of like 25 hours to get, and you know, one, we don't have to want to have to navigate a really complex kind of IVR. Yeah. I want to just call somebody and get kind of help pretty, pretty quick.
Well, so, look, in the last like 90 seconds, you and I have described the way that most modern people want to work with businesses, right? And so, you know, but my assertion is the businesses that aren't doing that, aren't matching that, it's not for lack of, you know, like evidence out there about it. It's for lack of desire to truly match the way modern customers want to be worked with. And that's fine. Like, they will go the way of the dinosaurs too. Somebody will come along with a better experience and match it better. But I think that more and more, as the pressures of, you know, modern service competition and that trust gulf increase, these businesses that don't match modern customers are going to become extinct.
Okay. So I want to switch gears a little bit and away from the research kind of paper, and sort of broaden out the scope, because this is something else the second thing I wanted to talk to you about. And it's a bit like we've done the state of, that's fine. So we know where we're at, in a ditch a little bit, but hopefully we've got some ladders to find our way out. But now when I'm going to say, well, okay, what does the future look like? I mean, of customer service, customer support, customer experience. I mean, what do you think? What would be the things that are going to define and shape the future?
Yeah. I think we are in a ditch. We do have a ladder, and in many ways that ladder is paying attention to our customers, but also some key technologies that I think will shape the future, in fact. So, you know, what I've seen over the last, I don't know, decade or so in service is, I guess the first kind of technology change I see that will shape the future, I think, is there's been a proliferation of channels, and we've been talking about omnichannel in the industry for a long time. But what's really happening now is there's just an explosion, and the pace of the number of channels that are out there is really increasing at a super rapid rate. I think, you know, you can think back to the olden days, like before the internet, right? The internet happened, and suddenly there were forums and websites and all these ways to get help. And then the world moved, and suddenly there was email and blogs, and there was kind of the second internet revolution. And nowadays, like, you have Facebook Messenger and Twitter and Slack and every possible communication, you know, vector on the planet. The interesting thing about that evolution to me is that the old channels are still around. So if you're a business that wants to engage with your customers, you need to just be always adding to the number of channels that you have. You need to always be simplifying it for your own service workers and for your customers to create a continuous experience across multiple channels. I think that's actually a really important thing.
So I said it almost exactly the same thing. I was speaking at a conference last week, and I was having a discussion with people around that very idea and the idea about simplification. And I said this to people, which kind of like blew their mind a little bit, which is, you need to be taking stuff away at a faster rate than you're adding stuff. And they were looked at me and went, what? Their kind of heads exploded. I'm like going, you know, this idea of like simplifying, you can go, okay, that's fine. But the idea that you've got to be taking stuff away at a faster rate than you're adding stuff, they were like going, well, it's obvious. But when you say it like that, they were just a bit like, oh my God, that sounds super hard. And the truth is, it is. But I think you're absolutely right, is that the, I always kind of say to people, I mean, there's a, I don't know if you know it, but do you know the Siegel and Gale Simplicity Index?
No.
So there's, Siegel and Gale are this agency that are in, I think the headquarters out of New York, and they've got this website called simplicityindex.com. Mm-hmm. And since about 2009, they've been tracking a whole bunch of brands that they believe embody simplicity at their heart, not from the brand's perspective, but also but from the customer's perspective.
Yep.
And they've been tracking the performance of those brands, and for the last 10 years, that portfolio of brands have outperformed the stock market in excess of 300% or something.
Yes.
And all their customer and all their employee metrics go in all in the right direction. So it's a bit like, you know, the business case is there. You know, so, and also the other thing I kind of think about as well is like all of these, you know, these pans of service excellence and things that we hold up, you know, regardless of which country you're in, everybody has their local kind of heroes. But I think the thing that's kind of, that's really obvious, that sits, that's hiding in plain sight with those companies is that they don't operate in a proliferation of channels. In many ways, they kind of, the number of channels they serve their customers over, you could probably count on one hand. You know, you think about Amazon. Amazon's held up as being this kind of this thing that this massive company that provides great service. They don't serve their customers over more than about five channels.
Yeah.
I guess the point is they get great at they focus on being great at a few things rather than kind of pretty crappy at a lot.
Totally. I think Amazon's actually a really good example because that's a world in which they've really studied their customer. I think Amazon is really a student of human behavior in a lot of ways. And I think they've designed an experience that they can deliver, you know, top 1% amazing quality at, right? But they focused and they don't do everything. They've studied their customer and said, this is what they need, this is what they want, and here's how we're going to deliver it. I actually think it's a very mindful approach. So yes, you do have this proliferation of channels, but I think as a business, you need to pick your spots, match the way your customers want to work with you. And your customers probably don't want to jump from Slack to SMS to WhatsApp all in the same day. They want you to kind of be like, this is the way you're going to have the best experience. They want to trust you and they want it to work. It's just that most of the time that trust is broken and it doesn't work. So getting great at one thing, I totally agree, is going to be much more to your benefit than being mediocre at 30 things.
And I tell you what, the other thing that's very clear about them is that they are very good at experimenting with channels, but then when they don't really work out, they kill them really quickly. And not necessarily publicly, they just go, yeah, that didn't work, and then they stop it. And it's one of the things that they, even as a massive company now, they're getting really good at it. They've just binned their Amazon restaurant sort of thing right now because it didn't work. They couldn't do delivery. They couldn't compete with some of the existing players. And they, in the UK, they just invested in Deliveroo, who is one of the major players, as a way to compete with Uber Eats. And so it's a bit like, they know when they're going to get a bloody nose, they pull back and they try a different way. Yeah.
I think that the brave thing, though, is that they know the bloody nose won't kill them.
Yeah.
Right? They say, yeah, I mean, this is going to be a rough, it's going to be a rough evening. Tomorrow's going to hurt. But next week, we're going to be fine. And you know what? It was better that we pulled out of that than tried to keep investing in something that wasn't going to work. I think that's really the brave approach.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So given all that, I mean, I think the thing that's also quite frightening about the about experience and service right now is this proliferation of technologies. Now, can that continue? Because I know that the MarTech sort of map that gets put up by, I think it's Scott Brinker or something, I think it is.
Yeah.
And it's gone from 5,000 to, I think it's nearly 7,500, something like that. It's sort of ridiculous, like all in that sort of, in a similar sort of space. I mean, do you think, are we facing, we've seen some big deals kind of happening in the last kind of few days, few weeks, few months and things. I mean, yeah. Are we facing a period of in more proliferation or consolidation? Where do you think that things are going to go?
I'm seeing some consolidation. And I guess I see it in a few different places. So just as examples, right? Natero, customer success company, acquired by Freshworks, kind of a suite software-based company. Smooch was acquired by Zendesk, right? They're a channel-based company. Looker went to Google, Tableau, Salesforce. And so a lot of those technologies are aiming to tie together disparate things and sort of make sense out of them. And they're trying to make sense out of, the customer experience, because everybody's looking at those brands that are winning, you know, the Airbnbs of the world, the Deliveroos of the world, whatever, and they're saying, oh, these guys have great experience. If only we could do that too. And so here's a bunch of tools that are promising that. And you are seeing industry consolidation around it, right? And I think we actually are at a time where we're at the beginning of a wave of consolidation nowadays.
Okay. And not to forget the human in all this, because we're talking about a lot of technology, but customers continually can like say that they get frustrated with the whole, you know, digital experience and technological kind of tools. I mean, and you talked about the evolution of support roles and things going forward when we actually start to really maximize and leverage these tools. I mean, what are you seeing and what have you learned in terms of what companies should do to strike that right balance between the human and tech in their service and experience kind of mix, as it were?
Yeah, the businesses that I see winning are simplifying the experience. So I actually really like your simplification in next example, because I think that's a lot of the way that you win. And they're really focusing on removing friction from the customer experience so that those folks have just a simpler experience. And I think more and more as a result, these businesses are winning not on product, but on experience. It's a very interesting change, right? And I think nowadays for me, like I'm part of this, as are all of us. And so for me, you know, when I like go to buy something, I tend to look for experience first. And the product has to meet a sufficiency of quality. But, you know, for instance, when I wake up in the morning on my Casper mattress, I'm happy with them because the mattress is certainly good enough for my needs. But man, it was a really good experience buying them. They had a 90-day money-back guarantee. They won my business on experience. That's happening all over the place. I look at, you know, Spotify with music or Lyft with car service, Warby Parker with glasses. It's just a better, easier, more frictionless experience. Any ways you can use technology to deliver that, cool. Any ways that you can sort of study your customer and match what they want to deliver that, cool. Right? But that's how I see modern businesses are winning. I think the consolidation in the industry is an effort to kind of hunt for that simplicity and package it into a tool set, package it into a suite that businesses can use to really study their customer and push out less frictionful ways of doing business.
And what's the human role in that? Because I think that's where we talk about trust and we talk about empathy and we talk about being there when people need us, almost like that sort of being the fire department, as it were, when things go wrong. I mean, is that where people or companies should be focusing on? Using technology kind of like to make things as easy and as friction-free as possible and helping people to self-serve, but having these almost like superheroes that get dropped in as and when things get dangerous or complicated or difficult or whatever. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the model I would advocate for, right? I think brands should look to build experiences that are as self-service as possible for the modern customer. Of course, that's an impossible order. It's never going to be 100% perfect. It's going to have some cracks in it. As you build it, things are going to go wrong, like our Amazon example, or things are going to go right. Those are happy wins. And I think that you use your service team really as the glue between all these systems, and you try to plug people in at points where they have leverage, right? You try to plug people in a way that they're empowered to actually help their customers. If you can do that, I think that's how you win. Self-service first, but always this kind of safety net of people are there. I think the people over time get more sophisticated, more empowered, more able to deliver really, I think, high quality solutions when they're needed, but they're needed less often.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the other kind of thing is that some people might kind of hear that and go, oh, does that mean that we're just going to have less and less sort of support people? And you go, and I would say to that, you will be surprised the level of sophistication we have as customers to come up with queries that have not been solved before. Like, for example, someone told me the other day, they were doing they were trying to program or teach a bot about a banking application. And they figured out that there was more than 200 ways for a customer to ask for what the balance on their bank account was.
Yeah.
I mean, that's mind blowing, but that's kind of what the data kind of like showed them. And so, please, folks, don't worry about our ability to become even more sophisticated in our requests to help and support departments.
I mean, I think in a world where if you as a business can make the base case, the kind of normative, like simple use cases of your product or service super easy, what happens is that your customers actually begin to ask for more. You begin to build trust.
Yeah.
And in that world, like the water finds its level, and in that case, the water's rising, right? And as a result, the service rep rises with it, the customer demand rises with it. And I think you don't end up in a place where, you know, half the service industry is out of a job. I think quite the opposite. You don't end up in a place where most of the service industry is working on more interesting work, higher order work, delivering more value with that human time, which from the business standpoint is the most expensive, valuable thing. Actually, I'm somewhat of an optimist about the future of the way this all goes, if businesses can really match where their customers want to work with and pull friction out of the process.
Perfect. So here's a question. Do you have any favorite new finds of companies, whether they're B2B or B2C, that you think are going, I think they're knocking it out of the park? I mean, because we all know who the usual suspects are. You know, we've mentioned a couple of them before, but have you spotted any kind of new discoveries, new brands or new kind of companies that are going, I think they're a new player and they're doing great right now?
Yeah, I think that startups in general are able to take risks that really match can match the way modern customers want to work. They don't have as much to lose. And they can kind of play differently. There's a couple of brands in the B2C space that I'm just sort of in awe of how like good they are. And for the most part, they're really small shops, right? So of course there's like the Slacks and the Dollar Shave Clubs and the Warby Parkers. We're putting them aside. Yeah. Right? I think that there's two industries that I'm really interested in right now, and they're very niche. One is the makeup industry. Okay. So these guys like Ipsy and Glossier and stuff like that, their makeup in some ways is somewhat commoditized. I'm not an expert, I suppose, but there's some commoditization of it, and they really are competing on experience. And that experience begins with a brand up at the top, and it pulls all the way through to customer service, a lot of which is handled on social, which is the way their customers want to be worked with. And I just look at that brand consistency, how the promise matches the delivery. I'm super impressed by that whole industry because I think it's incredibly competitive, somewhat commoditized, and really hard to win in. But there are certain brands that are doing an amazing job in there. Wow. I see that. And then I see there's a couple of like athleisure companies that I think are doing a tremendously good job too. There's Outdoor Voices and Roan in particular. I think those are two that just really match the way that their customers want to be spoken to, and they pull that all the way through the brand experience to service. And so they were able to design from the ground up a frictionless, consistent experience. They're able to actually deliver on it without the worry and all the risk that a bigger company might have. This is the way disruption works. I'm really impressed by those four.
Cool. That's a good list. I mean, and they also kind of, it changes the, if you like, the usual suspects kind of chart, because the usual suspects have been the usual suspects for a long time.
Well, those usual suspects, Airbnb, Warby Parker, 5 years ago, they were not the incumbents. They were the disruptors, right? I just think that the cycle time on this stuff gets a lot faster. The cycle time on innovation is going down. The pace of disruption is going up. And so if brands aren't matching it the way that customers want to be worked with, they're just going to end up off the list. And I love the fact that that's hastening and speeding up as time goes on.
Yes. So, building on that, then, if I was to kind of ask you to boil down all of the stuff that we've been talking about and say, so, Michael, what would be your best advice to any professionals or execs or leaders that are in that service and experience sort of space who are listening in today? What would be your best advice to them?
I think this has really been an interesting conversation so far, Adrian, because we've really been talking about the edge of the org chart. Okay, so if I'm talking to a service exec or a COO at a mid-sized company, and I were to reflect on the last few minutes, we've really been talking about the edge where the customer interaction happens with the team. Mm-hmm. We haven't talked about the VP and how to hire the right person there. We haven't talked about how to train management. We haven't talked about how the operations team works. What I think is that in the modern era, what you need to do is defocus on the operations, focus on the edge of the org chart, pay attention to the individual customer experience as a unit of one, track that, understand precisely what felt good, what felt bad, map the kind of empathy in that journey, right? And then remove all the friction that you can. And so I think a lot of executives spend a lot of time, and you know, sometimes rightfully so, on operations, personnel, and all that kind of stuff. But when that consumes and eclipses your entire worldview so that you can't see the customer, I think that's when you lose. Yeah. And I think most executives need the push to look to the edge of the org chart as opposed to the inner workings, because that's just where we spend all the time. And that's, you know, it's part of the job, but it's actually not how you deliver the most value. It's actually not how you provide leverage for your company.
Perfect. But what great advice. So thank you for that, Michael. So I have a couple of things that are a bit of self-indulgence, but an ongoing piece of social research. And it's based on my, published a new book. It's called Punk CX, that I've told you about before, which is, it's an homage to the Sex Pistols. It has a pink and yellow kind of cover with a bit of black and white on there. So what I've been doing is asking people two things. First thing is like, what one or two words do they think would describe a punk approach to customer service, customer experience?
So I guess I can't just like quote Henry Rollins here or something. I have to come up with my own quote.
We love Mr. Rollins.
So, I mean, like as a, washed up punk myself, I would say that the punk movement is about authenticity and being unabashedly direct and everything else be damned. You don't care about the consequences. You want to be yourself. You want to be authentic, right? So if there's one word, it'd be that. If there's two words, it's unabashedly authentic. It's an even stronger version of that. And, you know, I think that when you're trying to solve for the customer in the way that we've been talking about here, the brands that I respect, the ones that we called out, are the ones that are incredibly authentic. And sometimes even, you know, they're authentic in the sense that they are really for one population, one persona, and they're very clearly not for somebody else, right? And I think that's what makes you great. It's when you can focus.
But you know what's beautiful about that? And I don't know if this is a thing or if it's something that I've coined. Who knows? Maybe somebody can tell me. But there's this thing around, I call it the principle of adjacency, which is this idea that if you focus on a particular niche or market or whatever, and you get very, very specific, and you get great at being for that market, then actually that greatness has like a magnetic effect.
That
draws kind of people kind of into it, because people will travel for great. That's the thing. It's like, we know this, people will pay for better service, but they'll also travel for better service as well, whether that's digitally or physically. So I think, yeah, no, you've nailed it. And unabashedly authentic, but actually focus on that kind of niche and being very much like, this is not for you, this is for them. But that in itself can be a really attractive thing.
But when the them has something that they really love, sometimes the you ends up becoming the them. And I think your point about magnetism to greatness is so super true. So I look at a brand like a Patagonia or something like that, right? Yep. Really for mountaineering, you know, like hardcore outdoorsy folks, of which I am not one. But I love their brand and I love their stuff and I understand what they're selling. And they're very, very clear on it. They're very, very authentic on it. And to me, they're providing an awesome experience because they have a very, very clear sense of what their customers want. And even though I'm not really their target customer, I'm close enough. And man, I spend money with them. So it's going well.
There you go. So, Michael, final thing before we can wrap up. Anything that we've missed out that you'd like to kind of like point out, or are we good?
I think we're pretty good. We talked a bunch about all the research stuff, and I think that's really what we came here to talk about. I loved our conversation around like the way that businesses need to change to match the way their customers work. That's just an important thing to me. Yeah, I think we're good.
And so, where should people go if they want to check out the state of reports? Is it just like the state of customer service 2019 and search for it on HubSpot? Or
so if you act like a modern customer and you pop open Google and you search for the state of customer service HubSpot, you'll find it right away. Encourage you guys to check it out. It's 45 pages. It's chock full of good stuff. It's somewhat opinionated. I encourage you guys to agree or disagree with it. Have an opinion yourself. I hope you'll check it out.
Perfect. Michael, it is been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today about all this stuff and then explore some of what, you know, how do we get out of the ditch? You know, and there's the question to the audience is like, are we in a ditch or not? To ditch or not to ditch? You know, and that's kind of, and where we go from here. But just thank you for sharing your time and your expertise and your experience with us today. That's been brilliant.
Thank you so much, Adrian. Thanks everybody for listening.
Well, that's it for another interview. I really hope you enjoyed it. Now, every time I complete one of these interviews, I learn something new, and I try and incorporate that new learning into my writing, my speaking, my workshops, and the consulting that I do for my clients. If you're interested, you can find out more about how I work with clients over at adriansmusko.com. But one final thing before I go, please consider heading over to iTunes or whichever podcast platform you choose to use, and do leave a review. Every little helps, as they say. Anyway, that's all for now. Thank you for listening, and do listen in again. All the very best.